Hi, I'm Kate Laycock, host of DW's weekly European news podcast, Inside Europe. Our correspondents were there when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Balkans Wars broke out, and when Britain voted to leave the European Union. Now the continent is changing again, and we're rising to the challenge with our weekly combination of expert analysis and on-the-ground reporting. Find Inside Europe wherever you get your podcasts.
A win in Canada for Prime Minister Mark Carney.
As I've been warning for months, America wants our land, our resources, our water, our country.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today, American soft power after 100 days of President Trump.
The idea that the United States is the epicenter for higher education in the world, that the United States is an innovation hub, that the United States, by being a dynamic economy, attracts immigrants from everywhere else. We're about to test whether all those things continue to be true.
And 50 years later, a personal reflection on the end of the Vietnam War.
I jump up and down and scream the war is over, and I'm happy, not only for Vietnamese, for American too.
Plus, fighting climate change with puppets.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We begin with Canada's national election. It was called last night for the Liberals, making the party's Mark Carney Canada's 24th prime minister. He beat out the Conservative Party's Pierre Poilievre.
Carney campaigned heavily on a message about standing up to Canada's neighbor to the south. That's why Carney is expected to play a bigger role in global politics than his predecessors. Philip Martin of GBH in Boston starts us off today with this report from Toronto.
As the sun rose over the country's largest city, Canadians on the streets greeted news of Carney's victory with a mixture of relief and apprehension. Relief that Carney won.
Well, he'll be fine, such as it is.
But continued apprehension over the man credited with driving this voter, named Jenny, first name only, she asked, and millions of others to the polls.
God knows what Trump will do, so, you know, we're just a small, little, decent society that cares for each other and has some free health care. Don't pay a penny for health.
Even for many Conservative Party voters like Rudy Boucher, a salt worker from Northern Ontario, Trump was an issue in this election.
The guy's basically turned into a bull in a china shop, and basically he doesn't understand how tariffs work or why they're in place. He doesn't understand what a trade deficit means. He just has a point to make, and he's going to make it, for good or ill.
Boucher says though he voted for Pierre Poilievre, he wishes Carney the best of luck, and said he's going to need it dealing with a president who, without irony, says he wants to make Canada the country's 51st state.
Who's ready to stand up for Canada with me?
Carney took to the stage in Ottawa amongst supporters and made clear from the start that he would not be subservient to the whims and predilections of President Donald Trump.
America wants our land, our resources, our water, our country. Never. But these are not idle threats. President Trump is trying to break us so that America can own us. That will never, ever happen.
Carney is widely viewed as a moderate leader whose experience as a central banker will be juxtaposed against the protectionist policies of a right-wing American president who, 100 days into office, has alienated the U.S. from its allies in Canada, Mexico, Europe, and much of the world.
Our old relationship with the United States, a relationship based on steadily increasing integration, is over. The system of open global trade, anchored by the United States, a system that Canada has relied on since the Second World War, a system that, while not perfect, has helped deliver prosperity for a country for decades, is over. These are tragedies, but it's also our new reality.
And that reality also brings new opportunities, says Paul Knox, a professor emeritus of foreign policy and journalism at Toronto Metropolitan University. Knox predicts Carney will step into the position of leader of a multilateral world that is viewed less and less important by the Trump administration.
This is a person who's prepared to exercise leadership within the G7, someone who comes into the position prepared to take a leadership stance.
And whose pragmatic experience, says Knox, will serve him well.
Not only the financial world, but the inevitable bleed over to the political world. We can definitely project that he will have ideas about how to draw together an alliance to stand up to American bullying, if it comes to that.
Knox says from the perspective of Canadians, the American president has produced something no one thought could ever happen before, an existential fear of the United States, the neighbor next door. He says this threat is the driver of current Canadian-U.S. relations, but believes Carney possesses the temperament and the leadership to take on the Trump administration head on. That's why he voted for him, says this man, Leon, speaking as he was finishing up breakfast.
Trump is an existential threat to us, and so it's important to think about strong federal leadership to counter all of the threats that are coming our way right now.
And Leon, a lawyer, says he's confident that the country now is in good hands with Carney. For The World, Philip Martin in Toronto.
In Hong Kong, four former pro-democracy lawmakers have been released from prison. Claudia Mo, Jeremy Tam, Kwok Kha-ki, and Gary Fan served over just 4 years under the Beijing-imposed national security law. They were part of a group known as the Hong Kong 47. Its members were arrested in 2021 after taking part in an unofficial election primary the year before, with more than 600,000 people turning out to vote in the summer heat. Chris Chang is a reporter from Hong Kong who is now based in London. He explained why these four were released when so many others remain in prison.
According to the judges, different people have different sort of level of participation in the primary. So to the judges, these four people have the least amount of participation. So they were handed down the least amount of sentence, which is 4 years and 2 months. And so there was the first batch to be released.
I mean, the conviction was based on the national security law that Beijing had just imposed on Hong Kong. What does that law actually say?
The national security law imposed in June 2020 criminalized certain behavior, including in this case, subversion. So there's no very solid definition of that. That's one of the criticisms of the legal community internationally. In most Hong Kong voters' mind at the time in 2020, participating in an election would be perfectly legal, and they're not trying to overthrow the government. But the government's argument to the court is that what they're doing is effectively trying to oppose any budget imposed by the government. To the government, their argument is that if they vote down the budget proposed by the government, that would be an act of obstructing the operation of the government, hence a crime under the national security law.
So where does the pro-democracy movement stand in Hong Kong today? Does it even still exist?
Unfortunately, not so much. In the recent weeks, the largest pro-democracy party, the Democratic Party, is actually planning to disband after some pressure from Beijing, perhaps. There are other pro-democracy parties who have already disbanded. There are no mass protests or really any sort of protests except for maybe two or three people on the streets in Hong Kong right now. There are elections in Hong Kong, but Democrats would be barred from running in those elections.
And what about outside Hong Kong? Is there activist activity among Hong Kong exiles?
Yes. Where I am, UK, there is a huge Hong Kong population after the wave of migration since 2020. There are around maybe 300,000 Hong Kong people in the UK. So there is a huge community trying to do as much as they can for the Hong Kong community back home. For example, China wants to build the largest embassy in the world in London. And next week, there will actually be a protest in London about that initiated by Hong Kong people in the UK.
Well, it's interesting. Claudia Mo, one of those released today, she did not give interviews when she got to her Hong Kong home. But her husband alluded to an upcoming trip to England to see their grandchildren. And I wondered if there is a sense that some of these activists, now that they're out of prison, might leave but might not necessarily return. Or do they see their role in activism as too critical to not be part of the political life of Hong Kong in some way?
I think it's unlikely for them to continue any sort of political life in Hong Kong. I hope Claudia Mo can come to the UK to see her grandchildren, but there is a sense of uncertainty uncertainty as to whether they would be allowed to leave Hong Kong. Today, I've actually spoken to some of the former assistants in the Legislative Council, and they said they are actually expecting them to be not in touch with the former staffers because they may have to get away from any sort of political contact whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So we say that even though they have left prison in Hong Kong, they may be in some sort of bigger cage when they're still in Hong Kong.
Wow. Chris, finally, since Britain handed Hong Kong back to China in 1997, Beijing has long promised a one country, two systems approach. Hong Kong was supposed to retain a high degree of autonomy, and for a while it did. What is left of that autonomy?
Nothing politically. People can still live their life in Hong Kong if they do not participate in politics, so they can do their jobs, they can travel in and out of Hong Kong. But if they do anything political that is critical of the Hong Kong government, they may get themselves into trouble. And that wasn't the premise of one country, two systems. For Hong Kong people to believe in one country, two systems, it has to be that Hong Kong people should be able to participate freely in politics to express their opinion freely. But sadly, that's not the case in Hong Kong right now.
I mean, given the locus of Hong Kong activity there in London, along with what you described, China's plans to go big on an embassy, how comfortable do you feel there in London talking about what's going on in Hong Kong?
For myself, I think safety-wise, it's okay. I haven't faced any threats as a journalist. But there are cases where Hong Kong activists were followed in the UK and they may have faced physical threats. And there were recent cases that activists wanted by the Hong Kong government in the UK. The neighbors actually received letters from Hong Kong urging the neighbors to hand them to the Chinese embassy where they would receive a bounty from the Hong Kong government. That is around $120,000. So even though some of the activists have left Hong Kong, transnational repression never stops.
Chris Chang is a reporter from Hong Kong who is now based in London.
A herd of animals has started a journey from Africa up to the Arctic Circle. Not real animals, they're a herd of life-sized puppets. Zebras, wildebeest, monkeys, and giraffes. It is a large-scale art project called The Herds, meant to focus attention on climate change as it moves from city to city. David Land is the producer of The Herds. He joined us earlier from Dakar, Senegal.
When we were faced with the question, which artists are always faced with, which is what difference does what you do make to the world, we came up with the idea of creating a dramatization of what is currently happening to animal life all over the planet because of the way in which the globe is heating up. As people will know, and climate scientists have been putting out into the world for a long time now data about what's happening, but they're the first people to say it's hard for the public to take that in. What does it actually mean, 1 degree or 1.5 degrees? And they look to artists, to poets, to writers, to musicians, and to people like us to find a way of telling the story of what's happening in a way that has a strong emotional effect on the public.
So tell me what this actually looked like in, let's say, Dakar when the herds were moving through the city. Describe, you know, what that actually looked like to people who were there
so
to watch.
What happens of a day like yesterday, let me describe, one of the amazing beaches here in Dakar, the whole herd of about 50 animals of about 10 different species. We had giraffes, we had wildebeest, we had cheetah, we had lots of little monkeys and so on. Arrived on the beach, there were thousands of people, and then some amazing dancers who expressed some of the spirit life of the people here joined the animals on the beach, and they made a big progression along the beach with a big collection of local drummers, a really brilliant drumming troupe playing. Wherever we go, this started with the Mall, but it's true of the Herds as well. We commissioned artists to make new work in Lagos. There were two big dance companies, one from Lagos, one from Kano in the north, coming down to Lagos to work with us. So there were big explosions of dance in the city centres when the animals arrive and they engage with the dancers and then off they go into the distance.
There is so much awareness raising around climate change. So, you know, what kind of change do you actually think is realistic for your project to spark?
We don't make big claims to what we're doing. It's an artwork. It's a show on a very, very big stage. But we hope to suggest to people that something that they can do is engage. find where the energy is, find the people who are working to try and stop the degeneration of the environment, and everybody can do something about it.
David Land is the producer behind The Herds, a public art initiative raising awareness about climate change. He joined us yesterday from Dakar. You're with The World.
Hey, this is David Rind. I'm an audio producer at CNN. And one of my favorite things about working at CNN is that I can call up our super smart correspondents and reporters whenever I want to pick their brains about the news and the stories they're covering. Well, I want to bring you in on those conversations with our podcast, CNN One Thing. Each week, I grab one of those said reporters and we break down one big story that's been making headlines. Again, the podcast is CNN One Thing. Listen on your favorite podcast app.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Staffers at the U.S. Peace Corps found out this week they'd be facing a second round of cuts enacted by the Department of Government Efficiency, better known as DOGE. The Peace Corps is part of a constellation of U.S. agencies that for decades worked overseas projecting what's often called soft power. That is something many consider to be on the decline under the Trump administration, as agencies like USAID and Voice of America have also taken big hits. On President Trump's first 100 days into his second term, we wanted to look at what the dismantling of soft power is likely to mean in the long run. Daniel Dresner joined us for that discussion. He's a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. I started by asking him to define soft power.
The simple way of putting it is that soft power is a means by which you can get other countries to want what the United States wants. Joe Nye, who is a distinguished professor at the Harvard Kennedy School, coined the term in the late 1980s. He referred to three different components of U.S. soft power, the first being cultural attractiveness, the second being American values, and the third being U.S. policy competence. And the thought being that because the U.S. was good at all three of these things, particularly in the wake of the end of the Cold War, a lot of other countries would want to be more like the United States, which would mean they would have similar preferences to what the United States would want. And that makes negotiating an awful lot easier.
Is soft power still effective? Does it still bring the U.S. anything?
You could argue over the Trump administration's last 100 days, although to be fair, this has been a problem that predates Trump. U.S. soft power has been eroding, and it's been eroding badly. This is true for a variety of reasons, both due to Trump's first term, to sort of shifts in the overall distribution of power. But in the first 100 days, there's been a lot of sort of U.S. government institutions that were previously looked at as ways of providing soft power that now no longer exist.
Before the dismantling of these organizations, which is, you know, very, very recent, was soft power still bringing the U.S. what it wanted?
I mean, you could argue that even as recently as 2020, there were examples where the United States was still engaging in actions that wound up being copycatted elsewhere. Think about the George Floyd protests, for example, which originated in the United States, but then wound up going global, as it were. This might seem like an odd example of something that benefits the United States, but it demonstrated that the rest of the world was paying attention to the United States. And with the pandemic, with the development of mRNA vaccines, which in no small part the United States played a significant role, that would be another example in which you could argue that U.S. soft power mattered. But at the same time, there have been other actions that have obviously caused that soft power to be dented. And you could point to anything from, you know, the sort of stalemate in Ukraine to, you know, support for Israeli actions in Gaza as things that have dented American soft power elsewhere.
You've said that soft power is really on the decline since President Trump took office. What do you think the consequences will be of that?
There's a lot of sort of pillars of structural power in the United States that for as long as all of us have been alive, we've taken for granted, like the idea that the United States is the epicenter for higher education in the world, that the United States is an innovation hub, the idea that the United States, by being a dynamic economy, attracts immigrants from everywhere else. Well, we're about to test whether all those things continue to be true. And part of the reason that the best of the best comes here is that they know that the other best of the best is already here. So if you start seeing drop-offs in students, for example, that can have a sort of cascade effect and create a tipping point phenomenon where a lot of sort of elite institutions in the United States that have been the best of the best because we attract, we are a magnet for the rest of the world, suddenly that magnet becomes a repellent.
There are those who would see the decline of the U.S. trying to use soft power perhaps as a positive. The idea was to get the rest of the world to support the U.S. without, having to twist any arms. That meant, providing aid, but the aid was really in part meant to get these countries to kind of do what the U.S. wanted. What do you say to the argument that there is and was an element of hypocrisy in the U.S., wielding its soft power?
First of all, there's an element of hypocrisy in world politics, period. The idea that the United States is uniquely hypocritical, I find risible, to say the least. The second is that I don't think it's contradictory to say that the United States can do good and do well at the same time. Part of the reason that the United States is supposed to be promoting humanitarian assistance, part of the reason that the United States wants to promote its culture, is the idea that these things are both attractive but also promote American values.
What other things will you be looking at to understand what the decline of soft power that the U.S. has will mean?
One of the things I'm going to be curious about is the degree to which you have tourism both coming into the United States and whether Americans continue to go overseas. You've seen a dramatic drop in the number of international tourists coming to visit the United States. And then another question, which I'm going to be interested to see, is whether Americans become increasingly wary about traveling to the rest of the world because they are worried about being sort of tagged as agents of the Trump administration. Because they're Americans, they're de facto ugly Americans.
Daniel Dresner is a professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
The Museum of Fine Arts in Boston has closed its renowned but controversial Benin Kingdom Gallery. The space prominently displayed bronze and ivory objects considered masterpieces from the former African kingdom, now a part of Nigeria. The collection has raised questions about the legacy of colonialism, looted art, and proper museum stewardship. The renowned collector who donated the works has so far remained mum about the situation. GBH's James Bennett II reports from Boston.
The gallery first opened in 2013 after art enthusiast and documentarian Robert Lehman lent his 34-piece collection to the museum with an understanding that the MFA would gradually fold those pieces into its permanent collection. But amid discussion of the art's repatriation to Nigeria, the collector Lehman requested the terms of the loan be rescinded and the pieces returned to him. The return comes as the museum navigates questions about how to display such art ethically, since many of the Benin works can be traced to looting by British troops who invaded Benin in the late 19th century. Victoria Reed is the MFA's senior curator of provenance. She says, with Lehman's collection leaving the museum's hands, their focus shifts to return the five objects from Benin the MFA still has.
We do know that several of these bronzes were looted in 1897. We would consider them appropriate candidates for restitution, and we want to find the best way to make that happen.
With the majority of those objects back in Lehman's possession, the question of how to proceed now rests with an individual and not an institution. Professor Chika Okege-Agolu is an art historian and critic at Princeton University who wrote favorably of the initial terms of the loan in 2012. Now, he has some thoughts about the preferred course of action Lehman should take in the future.
I hope that he will make the right call, which is to enter into active negotiation with the authorities in Nigeria to seek ways of returning and restituting these objects to their rightful place.
Okeke Agolu says the conversations between formerly colonized nations and Western institutions have roots in the 1970s, but recent decades have seen more vigorous calls for museums to rethink their roles. In late June, the MFA will temporarily display its five Benin objects in the Art of Africa Gallery as it seeks an ownership resolution for those pieces. For the World, I'm James Bennett II, Boston.
There's a lot more just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Russia, new laws are aimed at suppressing just about any form of dissent. Hundreds of people are currently behind bars, in fact, because of these laws. Expressing opposition to the war in Ukraine, for example, is the kind of thing that can land you in a Russian prison. The World's Daniel Hoffman reports that despite relentless pressure, there are lawyers still working in Russia fighting for the rights of political prisoners.
A few weeks ago, 19-year-old Daria Kozyreva appeared at a St. Petersburg court for her sentencing. Kozyreva was charged with discrediting the Russian army. How? She glued a verse from a poem written in 1845 by Ukraine's national poet Taras Shevchenko onto his monument in St. Petersburg. During Kozyreva's court appearance, she delivered an impassioned speech.
Україна ще свободна нація. Вона сама рішить, якою йти дорогою. Сама рішить, кого считать другом і братом себе.
She said Ukraine is a sovereign country and it will decide itself what path to take, who to consider a brother and friend, and who an enemy. Kozyreva was sentenced to a nearly three-year prison term. Tanya Lokshina is an associate director at Human Rights Watch, where she tracks and studies cases of political repression.
Hundreds of people have been prosecuted over their anti-war stance, and sentences became much harsher after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Repressions in Russia today are raging.
Lokshina says that now there's a new fear, that the Kremlin is starting to target lawyers who represent political prisoners in court. The fear follows the infamous case of Alexei Navalny, the leader of the Russian opposition and the staunch opponent of Vladimir Putin, who died in a Russian prison last year. In January, three of Navalny's lawyers were each handed sentences ranging from 3.5 to 5 years of prison.
It sends a very chilling signal to any other lawyer in Russia who actually dares take on politically motivated cases.
According to the court's decision, Navalny's lawyers were part of an extremist organization. Sergei Davidis is the co-chair of the Memorial Human Rights Defense Center, which documents cases of human rights violations in Russia.
The lawyers should be cautious when they spread information. They should either do it secretly or even not to do it at all. They should limit themselves in speaking out. They should not condemn the war publicly and so on.
Davidis says that defense attorneys in Russia have almost no impact on the outcome of their clients' cases. The sentences, especially in politically motivated cases, are usually predetermined. However, Davidis says that lawyers have another important role when they represent political prisoners.
The main role of the lawyer now is moral, psychological, to provide the victim, the inmate, with the feeling that he is not alone. To provide him with some communication with the external world, even with his family.
Olga Podoplelova is a human rights lawyer who's still working in Russia, often representing political prisoners.
The Russian prison system is the prolongation of the Soviet Gulag system. It's the same walls with a different name.
But the Podoplelova says that many of the worst practices that were used against Soviet political prisoners are still used against political prisoners today.
The administration often manipulates prisoners. They can deprive them of family visits and phone calls, packages. They can deny medical care. They can also put people in solitary confinement.
But the Podoplelova says human rights lawyers understand the risks that come with doing their job, especially after the imprisonment of Navalny's lawyers.
The legal profession is still the way to be able to express your beliefs in a safe way. We do not agree with what's happening. So being a lawyer at this time is a good work to do.
But the Podoplelova says that there are few spaces in Russia where people can express dissent. So she says despite the risk, speaking out in court as a defense attorney is safer than speaking out in the streets. Marina Agaltsova is another attorney in Russia who's also represented political prisoners. For her, the arrest of Navalny's lawyers felt like a turning point.
It became more scary to defend them. I guess they instilled fear among lawyers.
Even during my conversation with Agaltsova, for a moment, that sense of fear was audible. Agaltsova was at a park while talking with me on the phone, describing some of the different types of political prisoners in Russia.
They voiced their opinions against the war. I'm sitting right now, and there are two policemen passing by, so okay, yeah, so they got into their car. Okay, so let's continue.
I asked Agaltsova about that moment, her reaction to seeing the police, and she says that in general she's drastically changed the way she communicates publicly. She doesn't write about her work on social media, and she's a lot more cautious about what she says outside or around strangers. Agaltsova says that she's trying to keep a low profile in Russia so that she can continue doing her work.
Everybody has to use the superpower that was given to this person by nature. And I believe that my superpower is trying to find justice or balance. With my knowledge and with my experience, I can make somebody's life better.
Agaltsova says that the mere presence of lawyers could prevent human rights abuses and mistreatment of prisoners. As the war continues in Ukraine, she says she still holds out hope that at times the legal system can provide a peaceful form of conflict resolution in Russia. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
The importance of trees for life on Earth is well established. They produce oxygen, and they're a key part of the climate system because they store a lot of carbon. But how much exactly is not perfectly understood. The European Space Agency aims to change that with the launch earlier today of a new satellite to gather data over the tropics. Matt Disney is a professor of remote sensing at University College London and is involved with the satellite project.
There's some evidence to suggest that large parts of the southeastern Amazon are going from a carbon sink to a carbon source. So they're actually releasing more carbon than they're taking up, probably because of droughts and fires. And again, this is kind of evidence that we have over, you know, large but still finite areas of that of the Amazon. And so we want to know whether that rainforest has reached a tipping point and is going from a sink of carbon where it's taking up carbon and storing it to actually a net release of carbon. So that's the kind of, you know, key questions where this mission comes in.
So it'll help give a sense of just how quickly climate change will progress.
Climate change obviously is a very important part of this, but also human impact. So deforestation, you know, legal and illegal, particularly, that has a major impact on carbon loss in remote areas. And being able to monitor that systematically, you know, across whole regions is the way that you can get different countries essentially to sign up to agreements or to, you know, to agree what is actually happening in these areas, because it's very difficult to kind of make decisions, whether politically, economically, financially, if the evidence you have for this is shaky. So you need evidence that is strong and that everyone kind of agrees, oh, OK, yeah, I believe those numbers.
So how does the satellite actually work, getting this much better picture of how much carbon is stored in trees?
Okay, so it sends out a signal, effectively, which we bounce off the surface, and it measures the height of the forests, and it measures the density of the forest, so how many trees there are, and it measures essentially the size of those trees by bouncing the signal off the surface. So we know what that signal looks like when we send it out. We measure it when it comes back. That tells us about the height of the forests and how dense they are. So it's building this three-dimensional map of the forest, and that kind of height and density map tells us about the biomass of the forest.
And this satellite can, in effect, see through clouds like others cannot.
Yeah, that's right. That's the difference between a radar sensor and satellites that operate in other parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. That essentially, if you have a satellite up there that's just taking pictures like a camera, obviously a lot of the time it will just see clouds, whereas this signal passes through the clouds, hits the surface and goes back. So we're not dependent on the sun, we're not dependent on it being daytime, and we're not dependent on whether there's clouds or not.
I'm curious, are there kind of more fundamental questions than those that we have been talking about how rainforests work that researchers are hoping to answer with this new data?
Absolutely. I mean, the three-dimensional structure of the forest, you know, how things are arranged in space and how they're arranged vertically, tells you an awful lot about the type of forest. And it tells you, obviously, forests are not just sticks of carbon. That's a very kind of limited way of looking at them. They're extraordinarily biodiverse regions, particularly in the tropics. And again, this vertical structure tells us about, you know, how this particular type of forest has evolved from one place to another and how it might be responding to other changes in climate and the environment. And so there are a lot of other questions that will potentially be addressed by these data. You know, the sort of primary objective, as it were, is the carbon side of things. But there's a lot of other questions about how forests operate.
Are there limitations to this technology or possible problems that are going to be keeping you up at night as this satellite gets to work?
It's got this huge aerial that's basically an enormous umbrella that has to unfurl over the next 4 days. And it's like 12 meters across. It's got an area of about 100 square meters. And this thing...
Wow, it's huge.
Yeah, it's this huge patio umbrella is opening slowly, hopefully as we speak. So the launch, getting up into orbit is the first thing. Getting the computer switched on and working is the next thing. Then getting the umbrella up. That's, you know, the key thing. Once the aerial is up and working, I think everyone will breathe a little bit easier.
Matt Disney is a professor of remote sensing at University College London.
Every once in a while, a teenage sensation rocks the sports world. Romanian gymnast Nadia Comăneci scored a perfect 10 at the age of 14. Skateboarder Skye Brown became Great Britain's youngest Olympic medalist at the age of 13. And at 17, Lamine Yamal is soccer's latest phenom in Barcelona. Now it's time for the youngest professional cricket player to take the spotlight.
Deep mid-wicket, over him! 100 of just 35 balls!
14-year-old batting sensation Vaibhav Suryavanshi cemented his stardom yesterday when he became the youngest person to score a century in men's T20 cricket, a format of the world's second most popular sport. A century is when a batter scores 100 or more runs in a single inning. The news made the front pages of newspapers across India this morning. Cricket commentators put it this way.
So on days like this, that what is possible is just redefined.
That was mind-blowing from a 14-year-old.
It's insane. I just think it's insane. I think it's absolutely mental what has just happened.
It happened during a game between the Rajasthan Royals and the Gujarat Titans in the Indian Premier League. That is the most popular cricket league in the world. In fact, one of the most popular leagues in all sports. Make it big there, and you are bound for stardom. 14-year-old Suryavanshi had only been a pro player for 9 days.
Technology has made keeping in touch with friends and relatives a lot easier. You can FaceTime, Zoom, follow each other on Instagram. But there's one low-tech tool that promises communication across not just miles, but dimensions. The world's Bianca Hillier first told us the story late last year.
In April of 2020, people everywhere were grappling with a new reality. Lockdown. Quarantine. For those grieving the loss of a loved one, the isolation was uniquely intense. In New Jersey, on April 2nd, Amy Dawson lost her 25-year-old daughter, Emily Dawson.
At that time, remember, no one was going anywhere. We couldn't have a service for her. Neighbors didn't stop over. Friends didn't, you know, you're on your own.
Emily passed away not from COVID, but from a prolonged illness. In the weeks following the loss, Dawson searched for ways to connect with her daughter, Emily. That's when she read about wind phones.
A wind phone is a disconnected phone. It is tied to the wind. It is not connected to any phone line.
Not connected to any phone line, but it is connected in a different sense. The phones create space for people to have a one-way conversation with their loved ones who have died.
So you speak into the phone as if you were just speaking to your person. You can say what you need to say. Maybe something you wish you hadn't said and you want to correct the record with them. Maybe you're angry. Maybe you just want to tell them about your day.
The wind, so the idea goes, carries your message. Wind phones are typically rotary phones and are mostly put up in natural environments where users can be uninterrupted and free to express themselves. Dawson believes the tool saved her life after her daughter Emily died, and she's far from alone. Thousands of people have used wind phones since they were created in Japan in 2010. It all started when a man named Itaru Sasaki built a phone booth in his yard so he could connect with a cousin who had recently passed away. Months later, the idea took on an entirely new meaning when the Fukushima earthquake and tsunami hit. Thousands of people died, and Sasaki allowed neighbors to use his wind phone to talk to them. In a documentary by Japan's national broadcaster, NHK, a man speaks into the phone and says, "All four of us are doing the best we can, so don't you worry." Grief, of course, is universal, and the idea spread quickly. There are now more than 300 wind phones around the world. I visit the one closest to me in Dover, Massachusetts.
This wind phone is at the base of a really tall tree. I'm looking up it right now, and it has to be over 100 feet tall. But the phone itself is about 3 or 4 feet up the trunk. The phone is red. It's an old school rotary phone with the dial, and it has a long red spiral cord.
There are a few rocks at the base of the tree, so someone could sit down while they're talking. And it's at the end of a dead-end residential street. Peaceful. Private. Dawson thinks that's how it should be.
It's just a beautiful, sacred space for grief to take that moment that you need, settle it somewhere in your heart, and then begin your day again.
Dawson now maintains a map of the world's wind phones online. There's one just outside of Wellington, New Zealand. Mo Blishin put it up outside her home, right by the sea, in 2018.
You should see the place now. It's like a little therapy corner because there's all these stones that people write on and stick on the wall as well. There's a book library that you can go and take books. It's just a nice little space, you know.
Other wind phones are in South Africa, Australia, and across Europe. In Canada, Leah Joy Friesen came across a wind phone while grieving the loss of her son, 16-year-old Mark Audrey Somera, who passed away in 2015.
I dialed my son's number as if he was actually about to receive the phone call. And then I pick it up and I just talk to him and I just release all those emotions. And I strongly believe that the wind carried those messages to him.
Friesen went on to put up a wind phone in Niagara, near where she works. She's a psychotherapist and offers grief support for a living. Now she encourages people to try out wind phones if more traditional talk therapy or coping mechanisms aren't working. She still speaks to her son, Mark, via wind phones on holidays and other important days.
Recently, on his death anniversary, I went there and just basically said, you know, it has been 9 years since you're gone and it's difficult, but you wanted me to be strong.
Grief has no timeline, she adds, and it's a good thing wind phones are always operating. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Vietnam War ended 50 years ago this week. To say it was controversial is an understatement. The war killed millions of people in Vietnam and inspired a loud protest movement in the U.S. Le Li Haislip was born in central Vietnam in a village that she's described as heaven. But when she was 12, American helicopters landed and turned her life upside down. Her memoirs formed the basis for the 1993 Oliver Stone film, Heaven and Earth.
The war got worse and worse, and the Americans became part of our landscape, part of us.
With war still raging, Le Li Haislip moved to California but stayed committed to Vietnam, going back often as an advocate for reconciliation and peace. When we spoke today, she told me where she was on April 30th, 1975.
I happened to live in San Diego, where the Navy town. Everybody had husband or sons in Vietnam. And they look at me that it's all my fault because I happen to be Vietnamese. And so when the war ended, I was very happy. I jump up and down and scream and yell, the war is over. And I'm happy for, you know, not only for Vietnamese, but for American too. But the people around me, I mean, it's the commerce that they make. It's just like Vietnamese. It's not a people. It's just like animal. Yeah, kill them all, and then we win the war and come home. But, you know, I'm only 25 years old. I didn't know about Vietnam, the war, why is American were there. You know, all this question I'm asking myself, but I had no answer.
It's interesting that your feelings after 1975 were to kind of understand what the war was all about, and yet you were right in the middle of it. So I'd like to just take a moment to recognize the evolution of your life. Tell us what your life was like before the Americans landed in your village.
I was born in 1949. So from 1950 to 1955, it's a war between Vietnam, you know, who is Vietnamese, against the French.
the French. They were occupiers.
Right. They were there for 100 years. Anyhow, when the Vietnam War and with the French, between 1955 to 1960, that's what the time, a very beautiful village. We had the bamboo tree, the pond, the river.
It sounds really idyllic, even though the French were there. Things really changed, though, when the Americans arrived. What changed for you at that point?
Now it's even more dangerous because we don't understand American. Who are they? What are they doing here? I mean, it becomes not easy to live in the countryside. The countryside now is battlefield. So most of us are refugee. I've been refugee in my own village, in my own city, in my own country at 14 years old.
Right. Well, you were caught in the crossfire in your village, subject to abuse by both sides, and you had to leave for your own survival. What did fleeing entail, and where did you go?
First, from the village to Da Nang City. And I stayed with my uncles and my cousin. And we come back to the village. It's very dangerous because of Viet Cong think we, you know, give information. So our family is very tough. By that time, I am already 14 years old. I've been in torture camp 3 times. And I've been raped. I've been starving. I mean, you know, I went through a lot at 14 years old. But if I stay in the village, I will be killed. Just like most of my playmates. By that time, all of my playmates are already dead or left the village. And so my family decided to send me to Saigon. That is when I was 14, almost 15.
Lely, let me just ask you, the abuse that you suffered, the torture, the rape, who committed that?
On both sides.
Both sides. And I'm wondering, I mean, the divide that you talked about between North and South Vietnamese, I mean, what did that mean within your own family?
My family, just like every family in Central Vietnam, we see why did outsiders all come and take our land, destroy our rice paddies, burn in our house, destroy our graveyard. And how did you feel if the Vietnamese come and do that to you in San Diego or in New York City or, you know, if anybody come and try to destroy that and take that away from us, we fight. But my brother and uncles and nephew all went to North Vietnam in 1954. But on my mother's side, everybody was in the South Vietnamese army. And so for us to be caught in between, nobody trusting us.
What you described, Lely, I mean, in a way, it really shows how the war continued in so many people's heads. You recently traveled to Da Nang for a ceremony marking the 50th anniversary of the end of the war. This was not just a formality. It had spiritual significance. Can you talk about that?
You know, Vietnamese, we believe life after death. So when somebody die in our land, if they die on the land, we'll keep the person's soul right at the spot where they killed until someone come and ask permission to bring that soul back home. So now on March 8, 1965, 3,500 U.S. Marines landed on a red beach in Da Nang. I don't know how many of them returned to the U.S., and I don't know how many killed in Vietnam, but 20 years war. But one thing I know for sure that at the Vietnamese, people recognized them, people honored them, people invited them to the temple and stayed there. To the West, you believe you die and you go to heaven. To the East, we believe you have to be peaceful with the heaven and earth before you can move on. Otherwise, you stuck in that, in limbo. And that is what Vietnamese, we don't want. Because we want everybody to harmonize.
What do you think is the lesson from the Vietnam War? What should the lesson be? And do you think we have learned it?
Honestly, we haven't learned anything. Why? Why did we send our brother and sister and our sons to die? For what? We have to live together and appreciate and forgive and love one another to move on the next level. And that is the lesson the West must learn.
Lely Hayslip wrote two memoirs of the Vietnam War. She joined me to mark 50 years since the war ended. We'll have more coverage of that anniversary tomorrow.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese, LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.